Good day and welcome to Letters in Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. After 114 years of publishing, the iconic Chicago black newspaper, The Defender, has published its last print edition. The Defender, over the past 114 years, has played a critical role in American history. It helped bring to light in the early 20th century race riots that were occurring across the country, including in Chicago, in which white people instigated and carried out terror projects against black communities. The Defender was also instrumental in reporting on practically every lynching that would occur over the next 60 years or so after its founding. The Defender will continue publishing. It will continue as an online site that you can still read. So with this all in mind, today I bring you a conversation I had about the history of this iconic newspaper with Eitan Makaeli. Eitan Makaeli is a former correspondent with The Defender, and he's written a book about this newspaper's history. The book is called The Defender, How the Legendary Black Newspaper Changed America. My good pleasure to welcome you to this radio station.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, you're not African-American.
I'm not.
But you worked for The Defender in Chicago during the 1990s.
I did.
What was that like?
Well, first of all, I should say that it was an accidental arrival at The Defender. I didn't know anything about the newspaper before a friend of mine, who was also a white Jewish University of Chicago grad.
I'm Jewish, too.
Yeah. And my friend offered to recommend me to replace him. He was getting a newspaper job in another town. And he said he was working at a place called the Chicago Defender. He knew that I was looking for work. I was an aspiring novelist in those days, and you know the ads for the want ads for aspiring novelists are pretty slim.
Yeah.
Then as now, my friend offered to recommend me. I went into the newspaper and saw all these historic artifacts, newspapers from the beginning of the 20th century, the portrait of the founder, Robert Abbott, beaming down on me in the lobby. All of that started to tell me.
Same building as when it was founded? Or in the early years?
Well, the early years, the Defender was even based in Robert Abbott's landlady's apartment. So
it's probably not there.
No, that building has already been demolished and replaced with the Illinois Institute of Technology structure in that. The building that I was in was at 24th and Michigan. That's still standing, but it's no longer the Defender's headquarters.
Okay. And I sort of highlighted that you were also Jewish, because yeah. What was fascinating is one of the beats that you covered while with The Defender was covering the Nation of Islam.
Yeah, it sure was.
Tell me about that.
It was really interesting. It was an important beat for The Defender. The Defender is not a nationalist newspaper at all. It's very much integrationist in its history and in its orientation, but it respects the nationalist movement for its legitimacy and for its presence in the African-American community. So the Nation of Islam beat was an important beat, and I had to earn it. I had to earn it by being a good reporter and reporting on things accurately and by taking a couple of turns at the Nation of Islam beat and showing that I could cover that beat as objectively as any other reporter. I got the chance to interview Minister Louis Farrakhan.
How did they feel? How did he feel? How did the nation feel about you reporting for?
You know, they
the
approved. They were fine with me doing that. Leonard Farrakhan Muhammad, Louis Farrakhan's chief of staff and son-in-law, personally had to approve my getting the beat with the other ministers in the Nation of Islam. He, of course, didn't have authority at the newspaper, but the other ministers at the lower-ranking ministers in the Nation of Islam did raise some questions about a white guy writing about the Nation of Islam. But Leonard Muhammad said that he had read my articles and that I'd done a very good job of covering the nation, better than even some of the African-American reporters at
for mainstream papers.
As he put it, I have to say that I know those reporters and they do a spectacular job, so yeah. I'm happy to be in their company and appreciate Leonard Muhammad.
Because you needed their approval for access to the nation, I imagine.
Yeah, I mean, it would have been difficult if they hadn't have approved it. So it made a difference, and I felt good that I was able to report accurately on the nation. It's of course it is an important presence in Chicago and in the African American community generally.
I don't mean to make and it won't be our entire interview about being a white reporter with a black newspaper, but I'm just interested about that dynamic.
Yeah,
you weren't the first white reporter.
No, I wasn't even the 101st.
For the Defender, not even the 101st.
No, no.
Has a long history of white reporters working there too.
There have been white reporters. There have been white Jewish reporters working at the Defender since at least the 1940s. Mm. And I say at least because there were if we go back further than that, we're talking about an era in which there were African Americans whose complexions were light enough to pass, and they sometimes worked in the white world, so to speak, in that way. And there were also incidents of white people working in the African American community who didn't necessarily advertise their racial identity. So I was able to track it all the way back to the 1940s, that was the first white Jewish reporter, a guy named Ben Burns, who worked there. And Ben Burns later went on to help John Johnson create Ebony Magazine, a Negro Digest, which then became Ebony Magazine. So he had a long, illustrious career in black journalism himself. There was a whole series of folks there, and if we want to include the printers and distributors, there were white people from the very first moment the Defender was published, although it was always African American owned and always African American directed in terms of its editorials. The newsroom was always run by African Americans, and the overwhelming majority of the staff.
Was that part of its charter? I mean, was that purposeful? Was that outlined?
Robert Abbott, the founder of the Defender, believed in an integrated America, and he believed very strongly that African Americans and white people should live together in the United States. Well, the newspaper was a part of that, and he felt that the newspaper needed to reflect that. So that's why he was open to having white folks work at the newspaper and open to collaborating with white contractors and white printers. And at one point, he even brought white printers to work at the newspaper when he bought his first printing press, because it was hard to find African-American printers. He would have had to have gone around the country and kind of gotten people from different parts of the country. And frankly, the labor unions in Chicago, the printers unions in Chicago, were not open to African Americans. They did discriminate. So Robert Abbott had to negotiate all that, and that led to having white folks in the printing room.
Well, tell me the story of Robert Abbott. Yeah. Not from Chicago. He was from the South.
He was from rural Georgia, from the suburbs of Savannah. He was born in 1868, right at right after the end of the Civil War. Both of his parents had been slaves into their adulthood and were emancipated during the Civil War. His biological father died before he was 1 year old, and Robert Abbott may not have even ever seen his biological father. His mother remarried a very interesting man who was of both German and African descent and had been raised in Germany but come back. He'd been born in the United States and then taken to Germany as an infant. And he came back after the Civil War to look for his father's estate in Georgia. Didn't find much in terms of resources there, but did fall in love with Robert Abbott's mother. And the Reverend Sengstack adopted Robert Abbott and gave him the benefits of his European education and his European outlook. This was essential to giving Robert Abbott a kind of global point of view and also a lot of self-confidence as a young man of dark complexion with a kind of roly-poly figure. He was really someone who needed that kind of reserve of self-confidence as he would try to launch the Defender and deal with all the difficulties of that in the early years.
And Sengstack, that will be a name we talk about more in a little bit.
Yes.
But before we do that, looking at the first Sengstack, who is the stepfather of Robert Abbott, did you get a sense of what it would have been like for a black man to be in Germany in the late 19th century?
Well, that was fine. That was he and his sister were probably the only ones in the part of Germany where they lived, and they were raised in a German family and treated more or less as everyone else was. When Robert Abbott became rich and famous, that family was extremely proud to have him in their family. And when Robert Abbott went,
and it was a white family.
It was a white family, yeah, of farmers and small business owners in around Bremen, Germany.
Wow. So the paper begins in 1905?
Robert Abbott launches the paper in 1905. This is an era, of course, in which newspaper technology is changing dramatically, in that newspapers had been what we would call a boutique enterprise until that moment, artisanal, if you will. It was expensive and difficult to produce, and Robert Abbott had been trained as a printer at Hampton Institute, now Hampton University, and he was aware that the technology had changed, and there were these devices called linotype machines, which were kind of early typewriters, which you could use to get a newspaper out fairly quickly and cheaply. And Robert Abbott wanted very much to take advantage of that technology.
A new technology.
That's right. And so it's very much like our era today. It feels very similar in that you see everybody kind of getting access to their own printing press, but we're not quite sure which media entities are legitimate or not, and the media entities themselves are not quite sure how to reach their readers. So that's very much what Robert Abbott was facing as well. A lot of skepticism from people who had never seen a newspaper with headlines and sections of editorial and news. These were all kind of new innovations that hadn't really been tried before. And at the same time, Robert Abbott was trying to build a national readership, which he knew would be the only way to sustain the newspaper and to really realize his vision of making it a national communications vehicle for African Americans, and also a weapon against Jim Crow and against segregation and oppression against African Americans.
Were there other black newspapers in 1905?
There were many African-American newspapers. There have been African-American newspapers going all the way back to the early 19th century, if not before. But there had never been a mass circulation newspaper. That was, of course, a new thing for the white world as well. It was Hearst and Pulitzer who kind of created those business models. And it was Robert Abbott who decided to take that business model into the African-American community.
More on Robert Abbott. You begin your book by him. This is before, this is still in the 1800s, late 1800s, before he began the paper, going to see Frederick Douglass speak.
Yes.
And it was somewhat fascinating to me, because when I think of Frederick Douglass, I think of how he's portrayed today, which I'm sure there's a lot of truth to this, as a very strong figure, a strong countenance. Yet in this speech, he's a much older man, and he's being heckled. Tell me about that.
This is the 1893 World's Fair, the World's Columbian Exposition. It is the birth of modern Chicago, really the birth of modern America. You have to imagine Chicago at this moment is, I mean, it's a beautiful city for all your listeners who have been there. They know that. But back in this time, it was really a way station to the warmer, nicer climates of the West. And it was a third of the city was a red light district where anything went, and where bodies of animals and humans who got on the wrong side of gangsters were just tossed into the mud and the muck. The World's Fair was, by contrast, just outside of the city, and was an oasis of technology and sound and light and electricity and culture and international representation from different religions and different peoples and different countries from all over the world. And so it was really this unprecedented gathering where you had Sioux warriors who were part of Buffalo Bill Cody's Wild West show, and you had Fon people from West Africa, and you had Inuit people from the Arctic Circle, and of course Irish and Germans and Brazilians and Japanese. Everybody was gathered there, and in the midst of all this was Frederick Douglass, 75 years old, the former abolitionist, friend of Abraham Lincoln's, a newspaper publisher himself, who was a national celebrity at this point, 75, but still vital very much a spokesperson for the African American people at this moment, who was fighting against the erosion of rights for African Americans. African Americans, of course, had won all of the rights of full citizenship in the Civil War.
And this is during Reconstruction.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then in the years after the Union troops were pulled out of the South, the Southern states rolled back rights for African Americans incrementally. Piece by piece, they were prohibited from participating in elected office, then from participating in certain kinds of businesses, then from riding on cars, streetcars and trains with whites. So all of these pieces of legislation were passed using a combination of terror, where whites would terrorize African Americans in the South to keep them from voting and to keep them from protesting and participating in the electoral or business processes. And at the same time, they would then use their electoral power to pass these laws and then lobby for those laws to be declared legal by the U.S. Supreme Court, which they unfortunately were able to do. This is all leading up to the Supreme Court sanction of segregation as a separate but equal concept.
Which periods sometimes known as the nadir of race relations.
Absolutely.
In this country.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Lynching was there were many lynchings carried out, and they were carried out in a systematic way to terrorize African Americans and to keep them from participating as citizens. So here's Frederick Douglass in this circumstance in 1893. And he has done everything he can to organize African Americans and to get African American intellectuals to come to the World's Fair. He's the master of the Haitian Pavilion. He'd been a former ambassador to Haiti. And so he uses the building that he's got control of to gather together a whole new generation of intellectuals. Ida B. Wells is there, the anti-lynching crusader. James Weldon Johnson is there, who would go on to run the NAACP. Paul Lawrence Dunbar, the first African-American nationally known poet in the country. Will Marion Cook, a composer of great talent, is there as well. And Oscar DePriest, who would go on to become the first African-American congressman from the North. All of these people are gathered together, and Robert Abbott is there as well. The future founder of the Defender is a singer with the Hampton Quartet at this point. And he's there. Hampton has got a great intellectual reputation then as now, and Robert Abbott is given special access to the white city. So all of the people, different peoples that I mentioned, and all the different nationalities that were represented there, Robert Abbott had full access to all of them. Especially if you think about it, after 5 o'clock, when the fair was closed, all of these people were just socializing together. Mm-hmm. They were, of course, employees essentially of the World's Fair, and so they were free to come and go and to interact with each other and they did. So it was really a wonderful moment, and it was the moment that Frederick Douglass really inculcated this new generation of activists with what would become the civil rights movement, the source code for what would become the civil rights movement in the 20th century.
Again, we are in conversation with Eitan Mekaeli. He's the author of the book, The Defender, a legendary black newspaper, changed America. So let's get past 1905 and jump forward just about 14 years here. So I found it fascinating, so-called race riots of 1919.
Yes.
in Chicago and other places in the country. And when we say race riots of 1919, very different than when people controversially will say race riots today. Sometimes people will call them other things. But tell me about what happened in 1919.
Well, so race riots in those days were usually whites attacking African-American communities, either in the South. Sometimes whole communities would be attacked by large numbers of whites with the collusion, at least, of law enforcement in the area. But in Chicago, Washington, and other cities around the country, what happened was that whites attacked African-American neighborhoods within those cities. So in Chicago, you had a circumstance where essentially the African-American community, which I have to say at that time was not yet segregated, the African American community was probably at least 50% white until these race riots. And it's whites coming to this African American area in what they called terror cars, which were, you know, cars where the passengers would hang out of the windows with guns and shoot at people on the street. So you had this scenario where these terror cars were trying to come into the African American community, and African Americans were defending the community by erecting barricades. Veterans of World War I sometimes took to the rooftops with their rifles and bricks and anything else that they could find to defend the community. So it was that kind of dynamic that led to the city being segregated. But it also has to be said that Chicago, in what came to be called the Red Summer of 1919, stood out as a place where African Americans fought back successfully, mm-hmm. where they were able to hold off the white community until the Illinois National Guard was deployed to kind of erect what they call a barrier of steel between the communities. And that was a formative moment for a couple of reasons. One, because it created the kind of segregation that you can still see in Chicago today, where it's not that African Americans are necessarily contained to a certain area, because that area would expand according to the needs of the greater population. It also meant that the city was segregated in the way that it hadn't been before, where whites were just excluded from, where whites were excluded themselves from the African American neighborhoods.
Was this at all a segregation for survival by the black community after the riots?
Well, it wasn't. The African Americans never supported segregation. African Americans never wanted.
And I don't mean like a specific. We want to be segregated, but I mean more in the sense of after the race riots, that just for pure protection, I guess that's.
Not every white person in Chicago was hostile to the African American community. Even during the race riots, it was particular groups that were engaged in that in those terror cars. Usually street gangs from white neighborhoods very close to the African American neighborhoods, and it was the white Illinois National Guard that they came in initially thinking that they were going to have their guns turned in both directions, if not mainly toward African Americans, based on what they had read and how they understood what the race riots were. In fact, what they found when they got there was that they had to turn their guns toward the white neighborhoods to keep the whites from coming in and attacking the African American neighborhoods. So it's always a complicated racial dynamic in Chicago, and it was no less so in 1919.
What's the Defender reporting on during this period?
So the Defender is reporting largely on lifestyle events for African Americans. That was always something that they were very determined to do, is to record the births and deaths and weddings and prosperous moments and less so graduations. Everything that was that African Americans that the white press ignored African Americans doing, the Defender was going to do that. But it was also a very strong advocate against lynching and Jim Crow and segregation, and it reported heavily on every lynching, on every incident of brutality that it could, and did that in a way to serve as a counter-propaganda vehicle for the white owned newspapers in the South that were putting out propaganda essentially to justify segregation and Jim Crow in the South. The Defender was born as an antidote to that kind of propaganda.
Did the Defender send a reporter to the South?
Many black reporters risked their lives to get the news back into the Defender. Some would change out of their city clothes into kind of workmen's clothes and go undercover as laborers or as farm workers in the South, which was, of course, incredibly dangerous. The Defender was known throughout the South and was reviled by the white authorities. They tried to censor it or seize copies of the paper. So if you were known as a Defender reporter, you would have been subject to any level of violence. There were also African American reporters for the Defender who, as I mentioned earlier, were light enough to pass as white. So some of them went undercover as white people in the South, which was again incredibly dangerous. Anything could have happened to them in those circumstances.
Who was Frank Fay Young?
Oh, Faye Young was Robert Abbott's, you could say his first employee, and he was a dining car waiter by his profession at that time, who dreamed of being a newspaper reporter. What Faye Young did at first was collect newspapers from the trains where he worked, and he would bring those back to Robert Abbott's office, which again is was at that time his landlady's dining room. And the two of them would go through newspapers. Robert Abbott and Faye Young would go through the newspapers from around the country, clipping articles that they thought were would be useful to their readers, and then rewriting them from an African-American point of view. So this was kind of a wire service, and for Faye Young, it was a training ground. Faye Young would go on to be the dean of African-American sports writers in the United States. He was a very important force in the integration of Major League Baseball, and was really a force of nature
How did, black newspapers, how did the Defender during this period of time cover sports? And well, what sports did they cover?
Oh, they covered the Negro League baseball teams, especially. They covered, there were a lot of leagues for African-American colleges and universities that they were big at covering. And the local sports, the high school sports and other games that were, you know, that mean so much to so many readers. Even when I worked there in the 1990s, we would, the sports writers would cover, you know, the high school teams and the smaller teams, and that was our most loyal following of the newspaper. People, you know, parents and kids, and the whole communities were so moved by that.
I mentioned that Frank Faye Young was a Pullman porter.
Today we might say we might group everybody together as a Pullman porter, but he was in fact a dining car waiter.
Okay,
it's maybe a slight distinction, sure. But
important.
But yeah, sure. And
but I mentioned the Pullman porters because the Defender was a national newspaper. It wasn't just a Chicago paper.
That's right.
And the way that the Defender got its publications down south was through the Pullman porters.
The porters, Faye Young went to his fellow porters, and at first he asked them for newspapers the same way that he collected newspapers, and he brought some of them to some of the individual porters to the Defender offices as well. Some of them became columnists or writers, but others got the idea that they could help the Defender's circulation. Now, this is sometimes presented, and I kind of thought of it myself, as the porters would come into small towns and toss bundles off of the back of the trains.
That's not what happened.
No. In fact, what happened was that the porters sold subscriptions to the African-American community. Now, this is very important in that if you understand that relationship there, is some guy is coming on a train and is telling you, a small farmer, sharecropper, or business owners, in other words, someone who earns their dollars very with a lot of hard work, and this Pullman porter is telling you should get a subscription to this newspaper, an African-American-owned newspaper, no less, in far-off Chicago. For that exchange to take place, there was a lot of trust. Mm-hmm. And Robert Abbott carried that trust as something sacrosanct. He made sure, no matter what, that every subscriber was going to get their newspaper every week on time. And he literally went without food or clothing to make sure that happened. It's that bond of trust that that was cemented with those dollars that really made the Defender into the national communications vehicle that it became.
I guess the could be argued perhaps the 1940s was the highest moment for black newspapers at its zenith. You can disagree with me on that if you like, but what was also important with Robert Abbott is what's now known as the Great Migration. African Americans leaving South, coming to the North. Tell me about Robert Abbott's relationship to this Great Migration. At first, he opposed it.
He did. I mean, he was a migrant himself, so he knew that it was incredibly difficult for African Americans to, frankly, find work in Chicago. Not because the jobs weren't available, but because the major employers, the stockyards and the factories, the unions that controlled the jobs in those entities, discriminated against African Americans. So Robert Abbott, even though he had a degree in printing from Hampton and was educationally and technologically superior to almost any other printer in Chicago, he could not find work as a printer. It was impossible for him. So he didn't recommend to other African Americans who had less skill than he did and less education and less intellectual acumen to come to the city and basically freeze in the streets. That didn't make any sense to him. What changed was in World War I, the number of European immigrants coming to Chicago and other parts of the United States dried up. Some European immigrants even went back to go fight in the armies of their homelands in Europe. At the same time, the demand for American products surged. So the factories and slaughterhouses in Chicago desperately needed labor. The only available source of labor was the African-American community in the South. Still, Robert Abbott didn't support the migration because he didn't see that this was necessarily going to benefit the African-American people as a whole. And frankly, there were jobs in Birmingham and Atlanta just like there were in Chicago. So this didn't make a lot of sense to him. What changed was when Robert Abbott saw that African Americans leaving the South, skilled labor leaving the South, would hurt the economy of the South and damage the standing of the oligarchs of the South. That's when he really began to understand that the migration could be a weapon.
It was hurting the South. The economy of the South was hurting because people were leaving.
There was a moment in Jacksonville, Florida, where stevedores from the port there left en masse for a port in New Jersey. And when that happened, stevedoring, of course, is a skilled labor that takes years to know how to perform properly. And the managers and overseers of those stevedores could not step in, nor could they train an entire new cadre to replace African-Americans. So the port essentially stopped working. When Robert Abbott read that report, that's what really excited him about the migration. And even though the Defender's news section reported without sugarcoating the circumstances in Chicago, without saying that there wasn't discrimination, because of course there was, just not in the legal sense, and that there wasn't hostility towards African Americans, which of course there was, it just wasn't legalized the way that it was in the South. The editorial side would say you've read the truth in the news section. You know that things are not perfect here, but they're better. And you leaving the South and coming to Chicago can be seen as an act of manly retribution. That's the way that they described it, against the Jim Crow South. And that was something that made a real impression on many people, because they could trust the Defender. And so when the Defender said come, many of them responded.
Again, we are in conversation with Eitan Michaeli. He's the author of the book, The Defender, How the Legendary Black Newspaper Changed America. You have a few photos in the book, and one that really stood out to me was Robert Abbott on his deathbed.
Oh, I'm so glad you picked that one. I love that photo.
He's surrounded by a lot of different men. I think they're all writers themselves.
These were Faye Young is in that picture, and many of the writers, and like Faye Young, many of the journalists that worked at the Defender didn't have formal journalism training, and very few of them had any opportunity outside of the Defender to practice journalism, even if they did have any journalism training. So they were deeply indebted to Robert Abbott as someone who gave them that opportunity. But all of those, if you see the picture, you can see really the adoration in their eyes for this man, their admiration for someone who had this vision that was so powerful and so resonant within the African American community. And I think about that photo a lot, because it was really, Robert Abbott was such a legend in his time.
He died in the early 40s?
He died in 1940.
1940, yeah. So the earliest of the 40s as you could be.
Yeah.
Talk to me about, and then, you know, this is just a few years after, Franklin D. Roosevelt, yeah. President Franklin D. Roosevelt, perhaps the most friendly of presidents to the press, but not towards the black press. It wasn't until, what, his last year in life in office and life, that he finally let a black reporter into the White House.
That's yes.
Part of the press corps.
You know,
you'll clean my description.
Well,
up.
It's a very interesting process because it's very clear from the beginning of Roosevelt's term that he is not a white supremacist, which distinguishes him from pretty much every previous president. He is personally very warm with African Americans. He and Eleanor Roosevelt are often pictured with African Americans. And if you look at the pictures, you'll often see Franklin Roosevelt shaking hands with African Americans. And I think even more significantly, shaking hands from the position that he was in naturally, where he was using a wheelchair, of course, or was seated, and he is then reaching up to African Americans. They are higher than him. That's something that that's a kind of optic that most American presidents would have resisted in every way.
That was published in newspapers?
It was published in newspapers.
Noticed?
Noticed and reviled by white supremacists all over the South. They were absolutely livid about those photographs and were furious. And so Franklin Roosevelt continuing to do that was only possible because of the kind personal belief in equality that he had, even though he's still a Democrat. And the Democratic Party is still at this moment based in the Jim Crow South. It's still the white votes in the South that essentially put him into the White House. So he can
and bring segregation to New Deal programs.
Absolutely. Yeah. They demanded it, and there was frankly no way for Roosevelt to resist that kind of pressure because they had the votes in Congress. They had the votes in the Senate. They had the seniority of their members. So Roosevelt, I don't think had a lot of room to operate politically when it came to African Americans, but where he did, he intervened on their behalf, such as when he brought, he more or less...
So was I wrong then in my description of what I said about his relationships to the black press? And I guess I got that idea, just to bring back the veil, from reading the New York Times review of your book.
Well, Roosevelt was, I think, constrained by the way his party was organized and the way the government was organized. I don't know to what degree he was aware of the black press as a force. He regarded it for the first few years of his presidency as a threat. He regarded it as something that was potentially seditious and looked at it as something like there was also a small number of newspapers that were sympathetic to the Nazis sympathetic to the Japanese Empire. So he kind of at first thought of the black press as maybe something dangerous in that way. There was a very powerful confrontation in 1942 between his attorney general, who had been directed to kind of clamp down on the black press, and John Sengstack, who was Robert Abbott's nephew, who succeeded him in 1940 when Robert Abbott died. And Attorney General Biddle threatened to shut down the black press. John Sengstack, the publisher of The Defender, called his bluff and said, if you think you can do that, go ahead and try it. And then John Sengstack went into a very passionate defense of the black press, saying, look, you don't give us access to the government. You don't give us access to federal officials. You don't give us access to your side of the story. And then you're surprised when we publish articles that make you look bad. If you want the whole side of the story, if you want your side of the story in the black press, all you have to do is open the door to us. And that made a great impression on Attorney General Biddle, who then colluded with Sengstack on various efforts to get the black press into the White House. They had to go around Roosevelt's press secretary, Steve Early, who was a Southerner by birth and had, I would say, tendencies toward sympathy with white supremacists, although the record is not entirely clear. You can't find anything that Steve Early said that was absolutely damning, but his record kind of speaks to that. At the same time, Attorney General Biddle and John Sengstack are working, and they are able to get a black reporter, Harry McAlpin, into the White House.
Was he a Defender? Or
he was a Defender employee who went to go work for the Atlanta Daily World. because the White House press corps, one of their requirements and one of the reasons they, the press corps itself, devised to exclude African Americans was that you had to be a member of a daily newspaper to get into the White House press corps. So John Sengstack dispatched Harry McAlpin from, who had been a Washington reporter for The Defender. He dispatched him officially to the Atlanta Daily World, paid for his salary at the Atlanta Daily World, and published his articles in the Atlanta Daily World and in The Defender. Hmm. And this is, I think, important, that when McAlpin does make it into the White House press conference, his first White House press conference, this is after white reporters are essentially threatening him and telling him that he might get beat up or he might cause a fight if he comes into the press room, and McAlpin is defiantly and very courageously saying that he's going to do this no matter what. And it's in that moment that when he's in the press briefing, that or at the end of the press briefing, when Roosevelt singles out McAlpin, again reaches up from his desk and shakes hands with McAlpin and tells him, "I'm happy to have you here. You're welcome." And from then on, that's it. African Americans can no longer be excluded from the White House press conference. That was a precedent that that changed everything.
John Sengstack and The Defender then would play a very influential role in the years to come towards desegregation and urging and pushing Harry Truman to desegregate the military.
Yes. Truman, of course, was a different character intellectually and politically and otherwise from Roosevelt. And
towards race?
Truman had, it was of course from Missouri and had been a member of the Klan, the Ku Klux Klan in his younger days. His voting record was pretty liberal when it came to race issues, but he had this background. And John Sengstack was not inclined at first to support Harry Truman, especially considering that his opponent, Thomas Dewey, the governor of New York, was a strong New Deal supporter, had a very strong civil rights record. There was no reason necessarily for African Americans to support Truman. It also has to be said that up until the Franklin Roosevelt administration, African Americans were members of the Republican Party, the party of Abraham Lincoln, and not the Democratic Party. So when Roosevelt died, it was really an open question whether African Americans would roll back to the Republican Party or not. And it was that moment where Truman asked for African American support that he desperately needed to win election, his first election in 1948, and John Sengstack essentially traded the Defender's support for Truman for Truman's commitment to integrate the U.S. Armed Forces. And he announced an executive order just a short time before the 1948 elections to make that happen, created a commission to integrate the U.S. Armed Forces, and put John Sengstack on that committee.
In 1947, when Jackie Robinson began playing for the Brooklyn Dodgers, which on one hand was a great leap forward for the country in desegregating Major League Baseball, helping to desegregate many things after that. On the other hand, though, it also sort of marked the beginning of the end of the Negro Leagues in baseball, which also had a very beautiful history to it. Now, granted, there are black newspapers still printing today, struggling like all newspapers, but did desegregation change black newspapers?
Sure. Desegregation changed black newspapers. Television changed black newspapers. The kind of riots that we had in the 1960s, where white reporters felt that they could no longer cover African American communities safely and competently, that created a demand for African American journalists to come into white owned institutions. All of those things diminish the Defender's clout as well as its economic power. It hurt the circulation. It hurt the viability of the newspaper in that way. That said, the Defender has always been a voice of conscience and has retained a lot of vitality because it's a voice of conscience. It was often the case that people at the Defender wanted it to become something larger. We often talked about that when I worked at the newspaper. Oh, if we just did this and this, we could become a rival for the Sun-Times or the Tribune, the bigger daily newspapers in the city. But the truth was that we understood that the Defender really has a specific role. I came to understand that the Defender really has that specific role as a voice of conscience, and that it thrives when it does that, and when it fulfills that need. So I think that when I was finishing the book, I had to kind of decide, is the Defender going to go softly into the night? It's, of course, it's down to a weekly circulation now, where it was a daily when I worked there. John Sengstack made it into a daily newspaper in the 1950s.
But before that, it was a weekly?
Before that, it was a weekly. It's now back to a weekly circulation, and it's down to about 5,000 copies per issue. But it still punches far above its weight when it comes to those moments where we need that voice of conscience, where we need to know what the African-American community is feeling or thinking.
We're almost out of time, but before we wrap up, we've mostly been talking about men in this hour. So I want to end by asking you about, who was Audrey Weaver?
Oh, she was the city editor for the Defender for many years. A great writer and reporter who cranked out articles, as you really had to do when you worked at a small newspaper.
Two a day?
Probably many more than that.
Yeah,
I wrote two a day.
You wrote two a day.
I was, you know, there were others that wrote many more. Chinta Strasberg, who I sometimes thought of as, I sometimes thought of myself as a competitor for her. But no way. Chinta wrote 5-10 stories a day, knew everybody in Chicago, knew every political player, every activist, every minister, and understood their political context, and was called upon by all of those entities, including our editors, to keep the community up to date on everybody's activities. So I couldn't, in the end, where I fantasized maybe about competing with folks like Chinta, with writers like Chinta, that I really did not.
And Audrey Weaver was the first female to be an editor of a city paper?
She was the first woman to be an editor.
Regardless, white paper, black paper, didn't matter, yeah.
Yeah. But the Defender had a history of women journalists going back to Ida B. Wells, who was really Robert Abbott's inspiration for starting the Defender in the first place. She was only a few years older than Robert Abbott, but she'd already established herself as an anti-lynching crusader. And she published a booklet during the World's Fair that was really a top-down investigation of lynching in the United States and its economic causes, its political causes. And that's, if you read that booklet, it really is a template for the Defender.
Did she write for the Defender?
She did. She wrote for the Defender until she passed away.
Did she write about?
Oh, she wrote about women's issues. She wrote about race issues. She was, the Defender was, covered the women, of course, got the right to vote nationally in the 1920s, but they got the right to vote in Illinois a little bit earlier. So that was a very important moment in Chicago's political history when women began voting, because nobody knew which way they were going to vote. So it really created a variable in mayoral and congressional and gubernatorial elections.
And did she write reporter pieces that we'd recognize today, or were they columns?
Both. I mean, she was a celebrity. She was a figure by that time of national renown. So it was. She couldn't report on things anonymously, right? Her presence caused things to change. So when she went, for example, to cover the East St. Louis riots in 1917, she wrote. The articles are filled with facts, but you can see that Ida B. Wells got a respectful response, probably a frightened response from authorities there, because once Ida B. Wells showed up on the scene, that meant that you were in real trouble.
Eitan Mekayeli, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. That was really great.
Enjoyed it. The name of the book, The Defender, How the Legendary Black Newspaper Changed America.